today on Against the Grain. What can sex workers contribute to abolitionist thought and transformative justice frameworks? Heather Berg's answer is a great deal. I'm CS. The gender and labor studies scholar joins me to discuss sex work, state violence, and much more, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Sex workers, many of them, are leftists. Some have studied political theory in reading groups or on their own. What they've learned, what they're drawn to, and how they connect theory to practice interests a scholar and activist named Heather Berg. The author of Porn Work, Sex, Labor, and Late Capitalism, Heather is currently working on an intellectual history of the sex worker left. In a recent article, she describes how the sex worker radicals she's spoken with engage with and interpret prison abolitionism, transformative justice, and the discourse of nonviolence. Heather Berg is an incoming professor of labor studies and gender studies at UCLA, and her article, the piece we'll focus on today, is part of a special issue of Radical History Review titled Feminists Confront State Violence, edited by Anne Gray Fisher, Sarah Matheson, and Marisol Lebrun. When Heather and I connected recently, I asked what prompted her to put out a call for thinkers on the sex worker left.
I put out this call during the initial months of the lockdowns of 2020, and part of my inspiration was really personal. I, like a lot of us, I think was at that moment filled with a lot of revolutionary hope. Protests around George Floyd were underway and just felt like something was really happening. And I also had some time on my hands and was hoping for some connection with people that I admire. And so the idea of spending those months talking to people who are smart and committed and dreaming big dreams about what we could ask for from the world felt really good to me at the time. So that was really my thinking initially. I wasn't necessarily thinking in terms of a book, but then the conversations just became so rich that that the book started to take shape. And the more kind of academic inspiration for what came to be the project is that I believed then and really believe even more so now that sex worker radicals really have something to say to left politics that is particular and that offers some really important pathways out of some of the dead ends of mainstream left politics. And I wanted to put those ideas to paper. The final thing is that I started thinking about these conversations in the wake of 2018's FOSTA SESTA, which were laws that really drastically curtailed sex workers' online speech. And part of the concern around those laws, of course, was around sex workers' ability to share safety information and to advertise and all of those things. But I was also really concerned that the laws were, and they indeed have, were erasing a record of intellectual history. And so I wanted to think about a way to kind of put those ideas to paper that might be more durable.
And SESTA being the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, what did your conversation with these thinkers, with these sex worker thinkers, focus on in terms of issues and topics?
We really covered quite a lot of ground. The book is now organized into chapters on first the home and the family and the couple form. They're thinking about sex workers' contributions to family abolition. That's one chapter. The next is thinking about sex worker radicals' critiques of the respectability of mainstream left labor politics. Another chapter looks at sex worker state theory. And then the chapter that is most closely aligned with the piece that that we're focusing on today is on sex worker practices of militancy and care. And so those are some of the themes that we organize our conversations around, but they were really quite wide ranging.
When you say militancy as one focus of your conversations, are you talking about the degree to which sex workers feel that they need to protect themselves and the method or approach they advocate in terms of how to do that self-defense?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. And I do want to be clear that there's certainly not one sex worker perspective and also not one sex worker radical or sex worker left one. People disagree with each other all the time in organizing spaces and their reading groups and on the page of the piece we're talking about today and in the book more broadly. So there isn't a unitary perspective, but what I'm talking about as tendencies and one of them, yeah, is to think in a really clear-eyed way about what it takes to care for each other when the state wants you and others in your community dead, or at the very least doesn't care if you do die. And when a lot of civilians or non-sex workers, but also people who aren't formally state agents, have been in some ways deputized to help in that violent project. So there is a tendency. There's, you know, obviously there are sex worker radical pacifists too, but there's a tendency that I'm really interested in to think about what kind of tactics might actually protect people. And for some folks, that does include a more militant approach to questions of self-defense.
Well, what should we know about the extent to which sex workers are targeted by the state? And what comes to the fore in my mind is the police. But you can certainly talk about other aspects of the state and of the carceral system, of the criminal injustice system. What do sex workers fear and experience in terms of state repression?
The meat and potatoes answer to that question is that there are all sorts of ways that the criminalization and stigmatization of sex work exposes sex workers to violence, both from state agents like the police and from clients and abusers masquerading as clients who have a lot of room to be abusive because sex workers are forced to operate clandestinely. That's especially true in explicitly criminalized regimes like the US, but it's also true of regulated regimes in other countries where the work itself is not illegal, but there are so many laws curtailing how you do the work, how you can organize and also advertise, that sex workers end up being exposed to violence even still. And so that's the nuts and bolts answer to your question. There's also, I think, a more kind of discursive one that sex worker thinkers talk about, and that's about how criminalization and repression and stigma send signals to abusers about who is, and I'm gonna, the piece talks about who's available for death. The sex worker poet Cassandra Troyan writes, and I'm gonna paraphrase here, but it's something like, he killed you because you were easy to kill, right? And that's in response to how one serial killer of sex workers described his motivation. And a number of abusers describe that they take cues from the state about who they might target. And we can see the material basis of that in all sorts of ways. One of them is that killings like this are permitted to persist in ways that aren't the case when other people are its targets. But again, also just all of the ways that criminalization pushes sex workers into the shadows and then very materially makes them available for harm.
What does this repression and criminalization do to sex workers' inclination to reach out to the state for help and for protection?
Yeah, it's another point at which there's a lot of disagreement. There are folks many of whom don't align themselves with left ideas, so aren't included in my project, but there are certainly liberal sex workers, folks who are more likely to be the kind of people who elsewhere in their lives have come to expect the state as a source of protection rather than violence. So people who are white and middle class, cisgender, etc. And sex workers in that position often talk about one of the benefits of decriminalization or decrim being that you could call the cops if someone's being abusive. And that's true if you're part of a community that is historically and today can expect to be well served when you invite police into your life, right? So that's, I think, a legitimate claim, and it's true for some people. And there's also a much broader left sex worker abolitionist critique that aligns itself with other abolitionisms to say that for the most marginalized sex workers in particular, the kind of promise of state protection is a false one. And we know this because of what this looks like in sex worker communities, but also what it looks like for all sorts of folks who have grappled with what it would mean to call the cops around, say, domestic violence, that when you do that as a person of color, as a trans person, you're likely to face compounded violence rather than remedy. And I guess I just want to add, all of that is true, and it's still a problem worth critiquing that the state is absolutely neglectful of sex workers' claims to protection. So it seems like an internal contradiction that some people are both calling for the abolition of policing and critiquing police inaction, but I think we can hold those realities together.
That's Heather Berg. She is taking up a faculty position in labor studies and gender studies at UCLA. We are talking about an article she wrote about sex worker radicalism and community defense that can be found in the January 2024 issue of Radical History Review. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. And just to note that the word civilian means, in sex worker lingo, a person who doesn't do or hasn't done sex work. Heather, does sex worker abolitionism or abolitionisms have implications and impacts beyond the situation of sex workers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks so much for this question. I'm convinced that if a political program doesn't work for sex workers, it doesn't work for the left. And that's not only because of my own particular solidarities and political commitments, but it's because sex workers are disproportionately poor and working class women and queers of color. They are disproportionately disabled. They are disproportionately single moms. They are folks who dare to live transgender lives and insist on ways of being in relation to each other that are outside the violent norms of the family. And so for all of those reasons, I think this community really encapsulates like so many of the questions that should be concerning left politics. And so if a political program doesn't work for a community at the crosshairs of all of those systems, I think for me, it's a failure of the left imagination. And so the piece is making some claims about the ways that the specificity of sex worker abolitionism, but it's also making a claim that the people whose, you know, kind of primary interest isn't sex work and what happens to sex workers should also care about these questions. And I think one of the things that feels really urgent to me in this respect, in talking about self-defense and how we take care of each other when we are under siege by the state and also by civilians who have deputized themselves as agents of state violence, is that we are all approaching an increasingly obvious fascistic turn, and the collaboration of the racial capitalist state and right-wing agents who want to help it do its work is becoming increasingly obvious, and unvarnished. And I think it makes sense for all sorts of leftists to start paying attention to what communities who have already known about that partnership. It makes sense to pay attention to their strategies and also to their political analysis. So just like one particular example of that is that anyone who cares about abortion rights right now should be thinking about how sex workers have been taking care of each other for a long time. These aren't rights that are going to be protected, you know, purely through the courts. We're going to have to, you know, break some laws to keep people alive, and think really hard about the tactics that are going to get the goods there. So that's just one example. But I think for anyone who's paying attention to the fascistic turn, you know, that we're all encountering, these are lessons to really sit with.
Yeah, and also you write that the call that some of the sex workers you spoke with are making is not that we do not deserve prison, but that no one does. Well, what sorts of tactics and methods do sex workers use to keep each other safe? What are we talking about? I mean, this is they're vulnerable to a large degree. They're in a room with a stranger, often a man. What kinds of things have sex workers done and strategized around in terms of making sure that, or trying to maximize the chances that they stay healthy and safe?
Yeah, so first, there's this wide range of strategies of information and mutual aid that sex workers deploy to keep themselves and each other safe. So that includes things like bad date lists, where you share information about abusive clients. It includes strategies of information sharing around best practices. For example, if you're someone working on the street, people share information about where to take a client, how to let a coworker know where you're going, when they should check in with you, things like that. They also include just a wide range of information strategies that take place online. Again, things like bad date lists, but also strategies for screening clients for safety, how to kind of look for red flags around safety, things like that. And I want to say that a lot of those methods have been themselves criminalized by policies like FOSTA SESTA, but also by a much longer history of the criminalization of sex work that often gets kind of smuggled into the law under the guise of anti-trafficking or anti-pimping policy, ends up defining as aiding and abetting sex work or as trafficking strategies for keeping each other safe, for looking out for each other. Another time-worn strategy for looking out for one another is to work together to maybe share an apartment in call. And in a lot of legal regimes, that exposes both sex workers to charges of pimping or living off the earnings of a sex worker. And that kind of policy exists even in decriminalized regimes, but partially decriminalized ones like Canada. People can be charged with pimping for sharing a space. So of course, what happens there is that people then are forced to work alone, which makes them more vulnerable. So that's just one like really obvious example, but there are all sorts of examples of how the law in some ways just serves sex workers up to their abusers. Again, if policies like FOSTA SESTA criminalize the sharing of information about bad dates, about abusers, it becomes harder to screen. This is good for abusers, right? So strategies around that kind of information sharing are huge. And then in terms of the kind of more immediate questions of self-defense, when you're up against the wall, sex workers also engaged in self-defense trainings, thinking together about how the particulars of sexual labor require a different approach to self-defense. So some of the folks in my article talk about the ways that this context differs from the one that's often kind of featured in traditional civilian feminist self-defense trainings, which assume a kind of stranger attacking you out of the bushes, which we know isn't the case in most. In most violent assaults, it's often someone we know. And so in this case, it's someone who's, you know, pretended to want to hire your services, or who's targeted you again because of the conditions under which you have to work. So those self-defense collectives are thinking really hard about how to keep people safe under those conditions. And they're also sharing the concrete information about literal self-defense tactics, like what kinds of jiu-jitsu moves are most likely to serve you in heels, for example. So some of that just kind of really nuts and bolts concrete information is also part of those strategies.
And then there's the case of Eileen Wuornos, W-U-O-R-N-O-S. What happened to her and what did she do?
Yeah, she's one of the more well-known women serial killers who was put to death by the state for her self-defense against a number of abusive Johns, some of whom were themselves state agents and some who were her clients or abusers masquerading as clients. She killed many of them in self-defense and was executed in punishment for that. She's become a really important figure for sex workers, sex worker radicals in particular, who want to claim her as someone worthy of our memory and defense, and also as a representative for exactly the problem that folks are identifying, which is that the state makes people like her available for harm. She was a very poor, often truck stop working sex worker who had to work in particularly vulnerable conditions, ones that made her extra, targetable. And so the state made her available for that harm and then punished her with death for defending herself. And it's for that reason that I think a lot of sex worker radicals and in these self-defense kind of conversations have adhered to her story.
Her name is Heather Berg, B-E-R-G. She writes about sex, work, and social struggle. She's author of Porn Work, Sex, Labor, and Late Capitalism. Her next book project is an intellectual history of the sex worker left. And part of that book is condensed into an article she wrote for Radical History Review about sex worker community defense and about what she gleaned from conversations and interviews with sex worker thinkers on the left. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're talking with these sex worker thinkers about theory, about political theory, and one set of theories that came up a lot is a transformative justice that includes visions and alternatives that foreground nonviolence. Now, we just talked about a woman who killed in self-defense and is a sort of celebrated figure by many sex workers. They see her, or they saw her, as a political prisoner when she was arrested. I think it was in 1991. So the sex worker radicals you talk to, what is their take on transformative justice and its emphasis on trying to resolve things nonviolently?
Yeah, thanks so much for this question. So I want to say that these thinkers, and again, there's a lot of disagreement within the community, but I'm trying to trace a particular tendency, are really in favor of transformative justice and often nonviolent resolution politics, as folks who identify with broader abolitionist movements and the transformative justice that they often put forward. But these thinkers, and this is where I think that the critique is really important and makes a lot of sense to me, are urging an abolitionist politics that thinks differently about different forms of harm. And so where a lot of non-sex work or abolitionist thought advocates nonviolent transformative justice, things like resolution processes within a community, addressing harm in an iterative and again, community-centered, non-punitive way. These sex worker abolitionists say that, yeah, that makes a lot of sense when your abuser is actually part of your community. It makes a lot of sense if you're thinking about harm within an activist space, for example. It makes a lot of sense sometimes when you're thinking about domestic violence, where you are, again, part of a community, a social world with your abuser, and especially for folks who are multiply marginalized vis-a-vis the state, folks of color, queer folks, don't want to expose their abusers to state violence, and again, know that state violence isn't going to make them whole anyway, and might expose them to new forms of harm. So for all of those reasons, these thinkers are totally on board with an abolitionist politics of transformative justice that resists punishment and punitive measures. They know, as civilian abolitionists often say, that like that doesn't bring healing. So on that they agree, but there is a tendency to depart from those visions when thinking about violence from clients and police, people who are not part of sex workers' communities, and who, because of their alignment with a broader politics of state violence, you know, maybe aren't the best targets for processes that aim to reconcile them with their targets. And that's something that many of the thinkers that I interviewed for this piece identify as a conversation that they're just not seeing in mainstream abolitionist discourse, which I should say mainstream for abolitionism is still left, but mainstream as in the most visible non-sex worker or civilian abolitionisms just aren't having that conversation. And the folks that I talk to are urging us to take it seriously. And so there is a critique of the kind of blanket invitation to nonviolence and to imagining that abusers can be brought back into community with the people that they harm.
How important to transformative justice theory is the understanding that hurt people are the ones who hurt people? And do the sex worker leftists you spoke with share that understanding?
Yeah, that's a kind of truism repeated often in transformative justice circles. And again, it makes a lot of sense in some contexts. We know that this is true in terms of cycles of violence around domestic violence and sometimes even sexual harm, that people who have been hurt often repeat those relationships of harm. And if that's the case, then a punitive approach really doesn't make sense. You're just exposing people to more harm and it doesn't interrupt the cycle of violence at all. And so again, the thinkers that I interviewed for this project largely agree with that, and I do too. But there does seem to be a tendency to sidestep or to just disengage in non-sex worker abolitionist writing and spaces with the realities of people who do harm, again, under the auspices of a violent racial capitalist state. So people who do harm not because they're marginalized or because they've been hurt, but because they already have power and they want more of it. And, you know, I think we could have a conversation about how living under white supremacist patriarchy hurts even, say, white men. Like, that's certainly a long-term feminist intervention to say, like, no one is served by this. But it is a different address to acknowledge that a lot of the people who do harm in these contexts, you know, don't have particularly sympathetic backstories from the perspective of left feminist politics. Maybe they have, like, fraught relationships to gender, for example, in other ways, but it's just a totally different conversation from thinking about say, folks within a particular activist community who are acting out trauma histories by perpetrating harm. That's not what we're dealing with when we're thinking about a lot of abusive Johns or certainly cops who use the protection of the uniform to perpetrate harm against people.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest, Heather Berg, is an incoming professor of labor studies and gender studies at UCLA. And you can read a piece she wrote about sex worker left thinking in the journal Radical History Review. So many of the sex worker thinkers you engaged with drew heavily from the Black radical tradition. And in that tradition, there are a number of thinkers who pushed back in very strong ways against the notion that nonviolence was the way to get from here to there. Among those thinkers were Huey Newton of the Black Panther Party, Frederick Douglass, and of course Malcolm X. And these thinkers and the way sex workers interpreted these thinkers come strongly to the fore in your piece in Radical History Review. Give us a sense of what at least some of the thinkers you spoke with took from these sorts of activists, militants, people who really felt that there were limits that needed to be acknowledged about what nonviolence could do in terms of the goals, for example, of African Americans.
Yeah, I mean, so I found it really interesting that these multiracial groups of sex worker leftists in their reading groups and also individually in their self-study were really attracted to these texts. And I'll say too that they tend to be like really self-aware about some of the risks of translation there. So they're not saying that sex worker movements are like Black Power movements. It's not this kind of analogy work, but saying that they're clear overlaps, not least because so many sex workers are themselves Black radical thinkers. But they're thinking about the connections with other folks, and in this case, the Black radical tradition, who have been theorizing for a long time what it means to imagine community protection when you know that the state is at best neglectful, but often directly a source of violence. The question is then, like, what kinds of protection are available to you? And many of the thinkers that these sex worker radicals are attracted to, like the folks that you've mentioned, are making an argument that nonviolence doesn't serve those conditions, that it doesn't serve a context in which civilian abusers, white supremacist abusive Johns, are doing the work of a state in helping it to discipline and to harm and sometimes to exterminate people that racial capitalist state has identified as threatening or expendable. And so that's part of the critique of nonviolence, is just a kind of concrete one. Like, if we actually want to protect the people we love from harm, we're going to have to do more than advocate a politics of peace. And so that's part of it. And then the kind of more symbolic element of these critiques that a lot of sex workers are really attracted to is the sense that a politics of nonviolence often rests, not always, and I want to be really clear about that, but often rests on the kind of suggestion that you might make appeals of moral suasion, appeals to the conscience of the other side, or at the very least, the conscience of the state that might then intervene on your behalf. But again, if you're part of a community that is targeted for removal and for silencing, that kind of capacity to speak to the conscience of the other side doesn't exist. And so if that's true, then nonviolence might just be acquiescence. And so it's in those kinds of points of connection that a lot of these sex worker thinkers are seeing are seeing some resonances, both tactically and theoretically.
Let me quote a passage in your article in Radical History Review. Quote, in their foundational document on prison abolition and gender violence, Critical Resistance and Insight call for anti-prison activists to understand the structural roots of individual acts of harm. But whereas transformative justice advocates typically frame this reminder as evidence that retribution against individual abusers can never be transformative, some sex worker radicals read it the other way. Close quote. Now, my question is, how could retribution against individual abusers, and here I assume it means, you know, a sort of violence waged against individual clients, Johns, be seen as transformative on the structural level? Killing your rapist, as the saying goes, removes one abuser, but doesn't transform the system, I would think.
Yeah, and again, this is something that these thinkers don't all agree on, and even the folks who are like kind of playing with this idea acknowledge a lot of ambivalence in their own thinking, and that's something that I also find to be a really refreshing tendency of these thinkers, is to actually talk about ambivalence. I want more of that from the left. I want more left tactical thinking that's saying, I don't know. I'm not quite sure that the certainty claimed around, for example, total nonviolence, like I'm not quite sure that's it, these thinkers are saying. And they're also not like hubristic about suggesting that they know that the alternative is clean. It's not that, but it's leaving some of the questions open. So I want to be clear about that. Like those are the contours of the critique. But the way that the structural individual abuser connection might work in another direction is that if we imagine that individuals, abusers are doing the work of a state, then it makes a difference structurally to remove some of that power. If people like Gary Ridgway, one famous serial murderer of sex workers, are helping, in this case, a white supremacist colonial state kill people off, maybe it makes a positive difference if he's not allowed to do that. And so I think that's the question. I'm trying in the piece to leave that an open question rather than to provide easy answers.
And feelings there must be ambivalent feelings, for example, when a serial sex worker rapist, like another person mentioned in this piece, is Joey the Player. Joey was eventually prosecuted for the rapes he committed, but you know, for someone who's anti-prisons and anti-carceral system, obviously, you know, maybe you're happy this person is put away, but you're not necessarily happy with the way it was resolved, the way this issue was resolved.
Right, absolutely. And so much of the teachings of abolitionist thought more broadly remind us that if you succeed in putting one abuser away, like maybe there's a marginal win there, but at the same time, you've also emboldened a system that is responsible for the abuse of so many people. So, you know, to the extent that Joey the Player's conviction authorizes a carceral system that is itself, as Black feminist abolitionists have been insisting, you know, for years with a lot of data to back it, that a system that is itself a source of untold levels of sexual as well as other harm, that's really no win at all. That's for most of these thinkers, at least, that's not so ambivalent. But yeah, I mean, to have him out of sex workers' lives made things better for some people in really immediate and crucial ways. And also, sex workers are raped by police every day. And so any kind of intervention that gives police more power, more money, but also just the kind of veneer of legitimacy, is going to expose sex workers to more harm.
Let's step back for a moment. You, as I mentioned at the beginning of this hour, you put out a call for thinkers on the sex worker left. Can you make any general statements about how the thinkers you spoke with, the thinkers who responded to your call, came to radical politics in the first place?
Yeah, that was a question that was really interesting to me. And a lot of the responses were surprising. I being in sex worker communities had been a really key piece of my own politicization as a left person. And so I sort of assumed that a lot of people also had been kind of radicalized through sex worker community. And that was true for a lot of people. There is something about being in particularly communities that begin around questions of mutual aid and then end up talking ideas, doing reading groups as well. So that is a really common source of how people end up coming to their politics and refining them. But a lot of people also were leftists before they were sex workers. And then, of course, you know, continue to refine and to shift their ideas once there. But it's not quite the direct kind of causal link that I maybe guessed that it was. But to your question about the kind of like general trajectory, I would say that there are two dominant paths there. One is that folks who were already aligned with radical politics for various reasons, many of whom, you know, had been involved in like queer communities, runaway youths who fall in with punks, and somebody gives them an Emma Goldman pamphlet, or folks who were involved in Black radical organizing come to left politics that way. A lot of people come to sex work because of their radical politics, not because sex work is at all a radical space, but because the comparatively like more money for less time working leaves a lot of space for organizing and for activism. Also for writing. And so a lot of people are drawn to sex work because it leaves space for them to have a broader political life that they just wouldn't or didn't when they were, say, doing 50 hours a week of food service. So that's one kind of common path for the folks that I talk to. And another one is folks who come to sex work, as many people do, since they need money and they need flexibility of conditions. And then once there, become radicalized through daily encounters with state violence, with stigma, and then also start thinking politically because they're in community with other people. So it's not an uncommon story for people to talk about meeting a sex worker or colleague, you know, when they're doing doubles or in the back room, dressing room of a strip club, who, you know, gives them a book, and then they start talking about ideas together.
And doubles are?
Oh, sorry. When you would do an escorting gig with one other person.
That's the voice of Heather Berg. She is author of Porn Work, Sex, Labor, and Late Capitalism. And we've been talking about an article about sex worker community defense that she contributed to Radical History Review. And beyond the thinkers we've already talked about, who are the other thinkers? Who are some of the other thinkers that are the focus of the reading list generated by these sex workers groups or individuals?
Yeah, some of the other folks that come up a lot of sex worker reading groups are thinking with Fanon. They're thinking with Angela Davis, with Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Those are some of the names that come up a lot, particularly with regard to the essay that we're focused on today. Elsewhere, folks are doing a lot of reading in queer of color critique, in queer theory broadly. And also, one thing that might be surprising to some listeners is that a lot of these reading groups are reading classic radical feminist texts as well, often from authors who were not at all friendly to sex workers in their time, but who sex worker thinkers are still finding kind of some theoretical resources in their work for thinking about life under patriarchy. So those are some of the places that folks go elsewhere. There's a lot of reading in crip theory and disability studies as well.
So your first book was Porn Work, Sex, Labor, and a Late Capitalism. What did you find out, or what did you report in that book about what porn can tell us about the nature of work today?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest takeaways for me from that book is that, contrary to the kind of dominant narrative of the labor left around gig work, around the digital labor turn, the gig work isn't something imposed on workers from top down. It's not just a way that employers have devised to better exploit people, although it certainly facilitates that sometimes. But that gig work, that demands for flexibility are coming from workers themselves, and that employers have responded to that in ways that absolutely do take more for less from people with fewer protections. But I really wanted to focus on the extent to which the demands for flexibility, for freedom from a boss, for freedom from a 9-to-5, those are workers' demands. They're not imposed upon them. And that's particular to porn work, that so many people come to porn work because they hated having a 9-to-5, they hated doing food service, they hated clocking in, not just because of low pay and long hours, but because of limitations to autonomy and creativity and kind of daily pleasure. So that's, you know, specific to porn work, and obviously this is a community that is willing to take a lot of risks in terms of exposure to stigma and precarity in order to find that autonomy. But I don't think the desire itself is unique to porn workers or to sex workers. And so I'm trying in the book to make a larger claim that this is something that a lot of working people want.
In that book, you go into the nature of the porn industry, and I think you even argue that there really sort of isn't one in the sense of a centralized profit-making enterprise or set of enterprises. Things have become radically decentralized. In the face of that, what kinds of labor organizing are porn workers doing? Can porn workers be expected to do?
Right. So if we're looking at a totally decentralized industry, it's really a mistake that, again, that the mainstream or civilian labor left is also often kind of willing to practice sex work inclusion so long as sex workers organize in ways that are completely legible and familiar. But a friend of mine often says, like, we're not auto workers in heels. Like, our organizing isn't going to look the same. And one of the reasons for that in the porn work context is that in a decentralized industry, there isn't a single boss against which to organize and to make demands. And part of that is, again, it's not just the vicissitudes of technological change, but it's that porn workers themselves wanted not to be working under coherent conglomerates of producers and directors. They wanted autonomy. They wanted to be able to self-produce. And they've harnessed platforms like OnlyFans in order to make that possible. And so, again, that's in response to what they wanted and to the changes that they have brought on in the industry. But it does make it harder to make demands of a kind of coherent managerial power. And so often the demands aren't against the boss, but they're against the state that is heavily curtailing workers' autonomy and their ability to safely make a living on their own terms. But those kinds of demands aren't often legible to a labor left that wants stories of, like, unionizing against a specific employer. And so that's a tension that I found, and I want to ask civilian labor leftists to be really careful about organizing these expectations in ways that don't actually make sense for what sex workers want on the day-to-day.
And so if the book is partly a cautionary note in terms of what left organizers should assume or think in relation to a porn worker, the porn worker predicament, what do you feel like the left could do in an affirmative way in relation to, or just from learning from, porn worker struggles?
Yeah, I think, again, because these demands for autonomy, for flexibility, for lives that aren't just a little bit more secure because you have benefits from an employer, but for lives that are detached from an employer, for lives that aren't defined by better work, but have less work or even no work. These demands, again, aren't specific to porn workers and other sex workers. It's just that this community, I think, has been particularly creative in figuring out alternatives and willing to take some of the risks that adhere to that. But again, the desires are a lot more universal. They come from pretty quotidian needs, like the needs of people who are disabled, which is, you know, given the mass disabling event of the pandemic, is a growing community of people who can't or won't clock in full time. They speak to the demands of single moms and other people who do a lot of caretaking labor. They speak to the demands of people who just would rather spend their time in other ways. And so the affirmation is not about a kind of performance of allyship, which often ends up feeling kind of condescending on the ground, but it's about like actually acknowledging that these are desires so many of us have for a different way of relating life to labor. And so it's less about allyship and more about a kind of humility and learning from people who've been having these conversations for a long time.
Heather Berg, author of Porn Work, Sex Labor and Late Capitalism. Her next book project is an intellectual history of the sex worker left. And a good part of that project is described in an article she wrote for Radical History Review, the January 2024 issue. The article is about sex worker radicalism and community defense. Heather Berg, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.